Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stanker. Anxious about the November election? You're not alone. From razor-thin margins to fears about polling location safety, election anxiety is ramping up. And with less than 2 weeks to go until the big day, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But All Sides is here to help. Today, we're demystifying the data, learning ways to cope with the stress, and exploring how our election officials are preparing for it all. We begin with polling and perhaps how not to freak out about it. Kyle Kondik is a managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. He's also the author of The Long Red Thread, How Democratic Dominance Gave Way to Republican Advantage in the U.S. House Elections. Kyle, welcome back to All Sides.
Good morning.
Vice President Kamala Harris has a narrow lead in the national polls, and she's pretty much tied with former President Donald Trump in most of the swing states. That sounds like it's going to be a close election, an election like the last two presidential elections on record. And yet people are all worked up about the polls, in part because they look closer than they were in 16 and 20. So are the polls tighter because they're more accurate?
Well, it's possible. If they're not accurate, and particularly if they're underestimating Donald Trump again, then Donald Trump's going to win the election because he's already knocking on the door of being able to do that based on what the numbers say now. That said, there are some changes that pollsters have made to how they do the polls. And so Trump's numbers are better. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, if the polling had been perfectly accurate in 2016 and 2020, those would have felt just like this election feels like. It would have felt really close to competitive because those races ended up being really close to competitive. You know, the difference between victory and defeat for Trump in 2016 was about 78,000 votes across Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And then for what put Joe Biden over 270 electoral votes in 2020, Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin, about 43,000 votes in margin in those states. So again, if we had had a better read on those places, particularly the Midwest, where polling error has been sort of more pronounced, at least in 2016 and 2020, again, we would have been on eggshells in that election, just like we are now.
So I want to talk about some of the changes that they have made and try to sift through whether they are making polls more accurate or perhaps less accurate. Or I guess we won't know until everybody votes and we have a final answer. But pollsters, like we said, undercounted Trump supporters in 2016 and 2020. And there's a lot of speculation as to why that is. But they've done this interesting thing to try and correct for it called recalled last vote. It's a wonky way of weighting a poll based on who they recall voting for in the last election. The idea being they want to accurately count Trump supporters. Nate Kahn of The New York Times has a great explainer on it if anybody really wants to go down the rabbit hole and recalled last vote. But it divides pollsters on whether this is a good idea or a bad idea.
Yeah, the historical knock on doing, you know, using recalled vote as some sort of real metric to wait on is that people sometimes don't remember who they voted for. And, you know, look,
which is wild to me. But
well, think about it this way, though, and this is how I think about it. So I follow federal elections, you know, religiously. I look at all this stuff. Of course, you know, I remember who I voted for in the past, you know, whatever. But then I think about like my own local like city council race or something, or particularly a primary, for instance. And like I would have voted in those elections, but particularly you get further away from it. Maybe I wouldn't actually remember who I voted for, you know, because I'm not drilling down on it all the time and thinking about it all the time. And a lot of people in the electorate may be that way too, that, you know, there can be this thing in which people, they remember that they sort that maybe remember voting for the winner, even if they didn't necessarily vote for that person at the end of the day. So that's part of it, is that sometimes these recalled vote methods or recalled vote will overstate how well the winner actually did. And pollsters have been hesitant to wait on this in the past, but they're desperately trying to find something that makes the numbers better. And this is one way of doing it. I mean, Nate Cohn talks about how it can be used to sort of hammer an unrepresentative sample into something that looks more credible. The danger is that it might just be creating a bunch of what we call herding in the polls, where like everybody's showing a really close race, and then maybe that's not actually accurate. Like maybe this thing is actually going to sort of break open a little more clearly one way or the other. I don't think it's going to be some sort of blowout, but maybe someone wins in a more significant way than we expect.
Yeah, one of the biases that I find fascinating is that it suppresses support for the party that won the last election. And so the argument against this is perhaps if you're looking at a super close poll, that they're overcounting Trump's support and Harris might be doing better than we think she is.
Right. Yeah, that's one possibility. You know, one of the other things that has changed with polling since 2016 is that, you know, you talk about weighting on certain demographic features. One of the things we generally know is that people with higher levels of 4 year of education level, which is likely to respond to polls. And prior to 2016, it didn't really skew the results, but since 2016 it has, because there's been this big sort of diploma divide between the two parties, with Republicans doing better amongst people who don't have a 4 year degree and Democrats doing better with people who do have a 4 year degree. So weighting by education was one of the things that came out after 2016, although actually the polls were more biased against Trump in 2020 than they were in 2016. So despite that fix, that didn't necessarily change the problem. Now, we also were going through the pandemic in 2020, and that may have had an impact on who was responding to the polls in a way that isn't present now, because we're back to normal.
Yeah, I do want to also point out that national polling in 2016 and 2020 wasn't terribly off. Like Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, Biden won the popular vote. It was swing state polling, particularly in that blue wall of the Midwest that was so wildly wrong. I actually think in 2020, was it Wisconsin that the New York Times was off where they said Trump Biden was up by like 16, 17 points?
Yeah, there's sort of it's sort of infamous. There was a I think it was an ABC Washington Post poll of Wisconsin that had Biden up 50, I think 57 to 40. And I mean, it was really, I mean, it was closer to the election than we're talking now. I mean, it was like a week before the election. And you know, that was the sort of thing where I saw that and I knew that it was way off. But I thought, oh well, at least, you know, Harris or Biden's got to be leading in Wisconsin by some amount. And I mean, he did win the state, but he won it by 0.6 of a percentage point. So that was really off. Now we're not really seeing those kinds of outliers really either way, you know, in terms of the polling. And so maybe some of these weighting things are having some sort of effect. And not every poll is doing it that way. The New York Times is not, and the New York Times has generally shown Harris doing or Trump doing pretty well in the Sun Belt states, but Harris holding up okay in the Midwest. You know, and so that's, you know, that's one of the dynamics, and I think they're very thoughtful about what they do, but you know, no poll is perfect. I will say that because the New York Times has such a big readership, particularly among people on the left, I think it's become basically the most influential poll in America. And again, I do think they're thoughtful about it, but it's also just a high bar to expect the polls to be perfect. And you know, the leads that Harris and Trump have in the swing states are tiny, and so you wouldn't ex you can't expect polls to predict the election with that level of precision.
Yeah, there is a question. So, if recalled last vote is giving Trump more support than he has, the flip side of that is that if pollsters are struggling to reach the kind of voters that turn out in presidential elections but not in midterms, those sometimes voters, the voters that probably skew Trump because he pulls in unlikely voters that could be hard to reach, then maybe we are underestimating his support once again.
Yeah, and I certainly worry about that, just because we have seen that movie before. It's just that as someone who sort of expected this thing to look pretty similar to 2016 and 2020, which again, as I mentioned before, were super close in the states that really mattered, I feel like the polls showing a really close race seems like realistic to me. Now, again, that maybe we're in for some sort of big surprise, but you know, so long as the you know we have you know similarly small margins in the key states, you know, it will have been as close as 2016 or 2020. Now, there's also this, what you got to remember is there's this sentiment among people who follow polls to say, oh, this is the closest to presidential election we've ever seen. But it's not actually the closest presidential election we've ever seen. It's the closest presidential election in polling we've ever seen. Doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be that way when people actually vote. And the bar for what is quote unquote a close American presidential election is pretty high. I mentioned how you know it was the key states were decided by a margin of 5 figures in 2016 and 2020. 2000 would be almost impossible to replicate because it was decided by 537 votes out of 6 million cast in Florida, and you have lawsuits and fights over recounts and whatnot. But that's about as high of a bar as you could set, how close 2000 was.
Methodology aside, any kind of poll has its limitations. And I think this is important because, when a poll isn't wrong, if it says Harris is up 51-49 and the result ends up being Trump up 51-49, that poll wasn't wrong. Can you explain margin of error? Because I feel like people miss this sometimes in conversation about polling.
Yeah, there's a margin of error for both. If you see two candidates reported, it's for the vote, the percentage of the vote for each candidate. So hypothetically, if you've got a margin of error of like 4 points, in a 51-49 poll, then the range of within the error, the range is like 47 to 55 for the person at 51, and what that would be 45 to 53, I think, for the person below. Now, if a poll is off by 8 points, you would generally expect that that's kind of a poor performance. But if a poll says someone's going to win by one and they lose by one, I don't think you can look at that and say, oh, well, they were way off. Like, I don't know. It seems like a pretty decent approximation of it to me. Again, it's just that like the race is seemingly so close that there are going to be a lot of polls that miss because the polls are showing just d slightly different leaders or small leads for different leaders in different places.
Yeah, if you look at the polling and the averages of the polling, so like the New York Times, 538, a lot of them, they'll aggregate all the polls together and produce like a polling average. And a lot of them are within the margin of error for these seven-ish swing states. So arguably, it might not be as probable as other outcomes, but there could be an outcome in which one of them wins all of the swing states.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even in 2016 and 2020, despite those being close races, the winning candidate in each time got a little over 300 electoral votes. So, of the seven key states we're talking about, which were the key states in 2020, they weren't quite the key states in 2016 because the electoral map was slightly different. But of those seven states, Trump won six of the seven, all but Nevada in 2016. Biden then won six of the seven in 2020, all but North Carolina. And like when I do, try to make a final like projection, my best guess is what's going to happen. My guess is I'll have, Harris or Trump under 300 electoral votes, but it's quite possible they will get over 300 electoral votes anyway, because maybe there's this break in which there's a, that Trump does a little bit better or Harris does a little bit better. And you see that consistently across the key states.
Pollsters also like to use the phrase snapshot in time. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, look, a poll, particularly ones conducted further out from the election, they reflect what's going on at that particular time, whatever the field dates are for the poll. So, a poll in May, it'd be unfair to think it could be necessarily predictive of November. Although I will say that this has also been a pretty steady race. And so, now granted, Biden was the candidate back in May and Harris is now, but you get my point. And this is why it's also can be important, although it probably more important in 2016 than this time, because back in 2016, there were a lot of people saying they were going to vote third party, and there were a lot of people who were undecided. This time, there are fewer people saying they're going to vote third party, and there are fewer undecideds. And so there may not necessarily be as much of like late movement. It seems like there probably was late movement toward Trump. He did win the sort of late deciding voters. He won the people who were the so-called double haters, the people who had an unfavorable view of both candidates, and maybe, polling that had been conducted closer to the actual election date, like maybe the weekend before, maybe they would have picked up better on that late movement. I think it's still, I mean, it'd be great to have as many polls as possible. And, it's easy for me to say as someone who consumes these things and based analysis on it, but doesn't pay for them. I'm curious to see if there's any sort of like late trend. We actually haven't gotten, by historical standards, it hasn't been all that much polling in the last like week or two, particularly from like sort of like bigger nonpartisan like national media outlets and what have you. I'm sure we will get much more down the stretch here though.
Yeah, I think that's a good point because I think what you mean by snapshot in time is that polls can fluctuate based on the respondents' mood. So a good debate performance, a good convention can produce a bounce that eventually goes away.
Yeah, the classic example of this is the first debate between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama in 2012. And basically, Romney did great. Obama did terrible. Everybody felt that way. And you actually saw it reflected in the polling that Romney got this sort of bounce in the polls. But what it turned out it was probably this sort of non-response bias, meaning that Republicans were excited. They were likely to respond to polls. Democrats were depressed. They were less likely to respond. It actually kind of moved the numbers. But we sort of found out later when looking at the whole sort of track of time that the movement was not real. It was just sort of artificial. You know, it's possible something like that happened for Harris after the first debate, because her numbers did get a little bit better after the first debate. And as we moved closer to the election, her numbers have gotten a little bit worse. So that would just be something to think about in the sort of postmortem of this campaign.
Final question for you is, you know, a poll's accuracy, a poll's quality can come down to all kinds of things like question wording, sample size, demographics, methodology. How can someone tell whether the numbers they're seeing, particularly, let's say, numbers flashed up on social media, came from a poll following best practices?
So there are certain groups like 538, they do have like a pollster rating. And also like the New York Times, they list all the polls, but they flag the ones that they think are the best based on how transparent they are, you know, past accuracy, you know, that sort of thing. And so if you see a poll that you don't believe, I mean, it's possible it could just not even be real. I mean, there's so much fake stuff that gets shared on social media. But I do think it's worth maybe looking to see if it's included in, you know, the 538 average or Rookler Politics or New York Times. And if it's not listed there, then now different aggregators have different standards for including polls. But if you don't see it anywhere, then that means maybe it's not all that credible, or at least that, you know, the sort of gatekeepers don't think it's necessarily credible.
And if you see internal polling from a campaign, know they're releasing it for a reason.
That's right. Yeah. So general rule of thumb, and there's actually, I think 538 actually has a number about this, and it's like an internal poll typically overstates the releasing party by like 3 to 4 points or something. And so, you know, and I, someone who assesses these races, if a candidate puts out a poll showing themselves, you know, tied or behind, you know, I do believe they're probably behind. So you just have to be careful with that. And, you know, the campaigns conduct good polling, but they're not perfect either. You know, there've been all sorts of times where the internal campaign polling has been off one way or the other. I think it was on the Democratic side in 2020, for instance. I think that Republicans back in 2012, a race I mentioned, were getting high off their own supply in that election. They were super confident about Romney and it just didn't manifest. So, you know, that they spend a lot of time on time and money and on the polling, but their stuff is not infallible either.
That was Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now that we've gotten the dirty on polling, or gotten the data on polling, the dirty data on polling, I should stop. We're going to learn how to manage your election stress. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Anxious about the election? You're not alone. A 2024 Pew Research poll found 65% of us say they always or often feel exhausted by politics. Here to help us sort through these feelings and what to do is a clinical psychologist and a political scientist. First, we have Jamie Renfro, an associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Her research focuses on election stress and how we got here politically. Welcome to All Sides, Jamie.
Thank you.
And Stephen Stosny, a clinical psychologist, consultant, and author. Welcome to All Sides, Stephen.
I'm pleased to be here.
Stephen, let's start with you. The Pew study I just cited also touched on anger and how more than half of those surveyed said they always or often felt anger. Does that surprise you? Should we read anything into that correlation?
It doesn't surprise me at all because my specialty is chronic resentment, anger, and emotional abuse in relationships. So I've been seeing it for 40 years. But what I've noticed in the last decade is a sharp uptake. People fight not just about politics and religion, which they always used to fight about, but they fight about the most trivial things like crumbs left on the counter. If they've listened to the news recently, that's what I discovered in my practice. I always ask couples what happened immediately before the fight started. And it was over 60% of the time they were listening to the news.
So how does political anxiety differ from general anxiety or other psychological conditions?
It doesn't really, because anxiety is a general central nervous system response. In other words, it's an alert signal, and you're hypervigilant to perceive threat anywhere. So the crumbs on the table seem like a saber-toothed tiger. Now, anxiety is a powerless feeling. Where the anger comes in is anger gives you adrenaline, and that gives you it's an amphetamine effect, gives you a temporary sense of confidence and power. And that feels better than the self-doubt and the unknown of anxiety. Self-righteousness feels better than being right.
Jamie, election stress or political anxiety is a field of study that's grown since the 2016 election. What have you been studying for the last 8 years?
Well, so prior to the 2016 election, most of the research, and there wasn't that much of it going on, really focused on cortisol. It really didn't occur to me at the time, but we were, it turns out, very into spit and studying cortisol reactions and how people were reacting kind of before and after elections, before and after their candidates won or didn't win, and what their stress response. Cortisol is the stress hormone that your body releases. And so there were a lot of studies that were focusing on that. And that's kind of where we established that there is a physical relationship between electoral participation and stress. Or your candidate winning or not winning, and your physical, not just your self-reported, but your physical stress release. I focused on cortisol, but like Dr. Stosny was saying, testosterone also got quite a bit of research during this time. And so the anger bit of it got a lot of attention too. But post 2016, more of it has focused on kind of that immediate reaction, like how people are feeling and how unsettled people have been feeling in reaction to elections, and specifically how different groups kind of differently respond. So that women may be more vulnerable to feeling stress after elections, or that groups of minorities might feel more or less reactive after elections.
Dr. Stanley, I wonder if this phenomenon is in any way similar to the stress and anxiety people feel about the sports teams that they support. You get all worked up about, you know, the Buckeyes winning or losing.
Oh, that's right. You're in Ohio, right?
Yes, we are.
No, it's different because the stakes are not very high in sports. There's always another year. As soon as you win the championship, you're worrying about next year. But in politics, it's affecting your home, it's affecting your family, it's affecting your future. So it's a lot closer to survival instinct than just sports. But sports are important. Go Buckeyes.
Thank you.
Ooh, as the I'm a Nebraska Cornhusker. As your opponent this coming up weekend, who's probably going to get stomped. I won't lie. No, you're absolutely right. I'll agree there. People seem to have a deep-seated response to politics that is different from other types of competition. It's related on that kind of like pituitary, that hypothalamic pituitary axis, but it's different because politics is about the way that you fundamentally think that society should be set up. And the differences between people, the variation in how we see that is extremely stressful for people. So when somebody, that's why this, what we incorrectly call communism in kind of American vernacular, that's why that's so scary to people, because it is in such like conflict with what most Americans think of as the right way to structure society. It freaks them out. That's very, very stressful. And so, yeah, politics does seem to have a different function for people than other types of competition.
You know, Stephen, as much as I hear from people who are worried about the outcome of the election, I also hear people are worried about, you know, the weeks after, whether the vote will be verified, what's going to happen. I also hear a lot of people nervous about going to Thanksgiving after the election and how to navigate those familial relationships.
Well, I think in all relationships, you have to focus more on values than on policy. See, we're divided by policy, but not that much by basic human values. Compassion, kindness, care is good, harm is bad. We all kind of agree on that. So if you try to direct the conversation towards values, and people like to talk about values and away from policies. Policies are going to have a bad Thanksgiving, though.
Yeah.
Because you have different temperaments in families, and different temperaments are going to choose different candidates.
I wonder, Jamie, do we see any difference in how people are expressing election anxiety this year versus 2020? And I know 2020 was different because we were in the middle of a pandemic, which came with its own stress and anxiety and fears.
Yeah. So, 2020 is just like the research that happened around the 2020 election. We almost like accept that we cannot generalize, you know, because who even knows what was real and what wasn't real, you know, and those findings. But one of the interesting things that came out of that election was that it flipped, like who was more and who was less anxious afterward flipped what we were expecting. And it was Trump supporters and conservatives who were experiencing less anxiety. And it was people who were Biden supporters and who follow the news closely and say that they are highly interested in politics who expressed the most anxiety, even though their candidate won. And that was a very interesting finding that either could just be some weird 2020 thing, or it could be indicative of a fear that something was going to happen. And something did happen. And so in my experience this time around, that's what's happening again. And I'm seeing, no matter what the polls are saying, I'm seeing, you know, more conservative, you know, friends and family feeling pretty good about the election. And I am seeing my more liberal friends and family freaking out, not just about the results, but about no matter what the results are, what's going to happen afterward.
So maybe it isn't a pandemic fluke then. But oh, go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah. What I've noticed since 2016 is that there's less support for a candidate than opposition to a candidate. So it's not so much what you're for as who you're against. And that's why you get more anger. When you're motivated by being against something, you're angry. If you're for something, you're impassioned. And passion generates energy, anger depletes energy. And anger generalizes. You're going to be irritable to your kids if you're angry about the election. So the opposition, I think, is we're not really for anything. So after the election, you're going to have buyer's remorse by the if your candidate wins, and anger if your candidate loses. So it's not going to be you're not going to be euphoric if your candidate wins.
And this is one of the things that comes from the way that we do our primary system. You know, that people tend to be more passionate about the candidates in the primaries. In the primary, the candidates can be more different from each other in terms of their policy positions and their extremity in their different positions. And then they tend to get a little bit more neutral in those, or they tend to draw back a little bit in the general election because they're trying to draw the bigger, you're trying to get people from the other side. They're trying to draw in more independents. And so they tend to get more moderate, and that makes them lose some of that, those passionate supporters. And they get people who are like, meh, I'm voting because, you know, for them because that's the party I vote for, because I agree with many of their, or because I hate that other guy.
It sounds like Democrats in Ohio get a bit of a double whammy. If they're more nervous about the election, they all, people who live in states where they are politically dissimilar from the average voter also report experiencing more stress and worsening physical health. And Ohio is now pretty officially a red state. So Ohio Democrats are probably feeling all of the stress right now, Jamie.
There's an interesting study that came out. It came out in 2020, but that means that it's from before 2020. In the Journal of Applied Health Economic Policy, that shows that the death rate in highly partisan counties increases by as much as 3% after a political loss.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, that's.
The election can kill you.
3% isn't very high unless you're talking about death.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty significant number. So, I mean, this is real. There are real consequences. And anxiety, you know, as a political scientist, we tend to, you know, oh, anxiety makes people not show up to the polls. It makes people not participate. I mean, that's what we're studying. But if we had somebody from public health with us, for example, right now, there are more heart attacks. There's higher blood pressure. There are physical things that happen when people have higher levels of anxiety. And so, like, there are real consequences when these things happen that it's not my field. And it's kind of my colleague here on the show's field, but it has much broader consequences even than those of us here on the show today.
Sure. Anxiety is like a smoke alarm that won't turn off. It's an endless alarm.
Yes.
One of my favorite quotes about it, it's like being in a rocking chair. You're moving a lot, but you're not going anywhere.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it. After the 2016 election, Stephen, it was found that voters who reframed their negative thoughts about the outcome using cognitive reappraisal techniques had better emotional well-being. So this feels like a good time to ask, regardless of if you're disappointed in the election on November 5th or whenever we have a result in the presidential election, what can you do to mitigate those symptoms?
Well, the wild card in anxiety is perceived ability to cope. In other words, something bad is going to happen and I'm not going to be able to handle it. Now, the thing you have to remember about a perceived ability to cope is it's always lower than actual ability to cope. In other words, we underestimate our ability to cope. So I always ask my clients, well, how did you vote for the last election? How did you cope with the results of that? And they coped pretty well. It's the fear that you won't be. We're not descended from the early humans who overestimated their ability to cope. who thought they could jump across the cliff or take on the saber-toothed tiger, we're descended from the ones who worried about it. The other thing is, anxiety makes your brain scan. You're taking a lot of superficial information. And when you do that, it becomes reality testing diminishes. So I ask clients to write down what they're worried about and then how they would cope with it if the worst happens. Plan what you'll do if your candidate loses.
If you break apart the age groups in some of these polls, the highest levels of anxiety come in the oldest and the youngest people who are polled. And so many of my students here at the University of Northern Iowa feel very, very high levels of anxiety. And part of that is because they have their whole lives, you know, ahead of them that they're going to have to deal with all this stuff. And part of it is just because there are higher levels of anxiety, period, over, you know, in this age group. But in a similar vein, different flavor because of our differing jobs, what I say to my students is that we've had bad presidents before. We've had presidents that people disagree with before. Other countries have had bad presidents before. Other countries have had presidents who go to jail. Things have happened before, and it has not ended the world. And it has not necessarily ended those countries, and not necessarily terrible things have happened. And often just the next election comes and things turn back around and you never know, but it is not necessarily the end of everything. And usually we just keep going on. And then they're like, oh, yeah. And I tell them who Berlusconi is and they're like, oh, yeah.
That was Jamie Renfro, an associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you so much. And thanks to Stephen Stasny, a clinical psychologist, consultant, and author. Coming up, we're going to hear from the Franklin County Board of Elections about how they're getting ready. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. For Ohio's 88 County Board of Elections, this is the busiest time of the year. This is their Super Bowl, if you will. From early voting and poll worker training to worries about aggressive voters and outright intimidation, it can be a stressful time of year for the people who work to make our elections happen. Anton White is the director of the Franklin County Board of Elections, a position he's held for the last 4 years. Welcome to All Sides, Anton.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. It's a good time of the year to vote.
We're under the 2-week mark before the November 5th election. Are you getting much sleep these days?
We're getting a few hours a night. But, you know, in the run up to November 5th, we got a lot of processes and tasks we got to complete. So we're getting prepared.
I want to talk about some of the election security that you have, because I think sometimes people worry about this. Like, anecdotally, I was talking to my physical therapist, and she didn't realize that absentee ballots are opened and the signatures are looked at by a Republican and a Democrat. And she was like, oh, that makes me feel a lot better about this process, that there is a bipartisan team that handles the ballots. So what other things happen that might give somebody who's worried about the integrity of the election some comfort?
Well, I think, you know, what's unique about Ohio is how we have bipartisan oversight of our elections. And so in every county here in Ohio, you have a Democrat and a Republican who serve as either a director or deputy director who oversee the election process. That's very different than in some states where you have, maybe an elected clerk or an elected supervisor that oversees the process. Doesn't mean it's less secure, but I think what we do well here in Ohio is that we do have that bipartisan oversight. And so everything from, not only cameras in our office, but we have all our rooms are secured under Democrat and Republican locks. And we have electronic access points where we have to enter rooms that contain live ballots. You have to do that with a Democrat and Republican. So we, as you noted, we check signatures with a Democrat and Republican. We check every provisional ballot after the election with a Democrat and Republican. So those are the types of things that I think voters can rest assured that we do things in a bipartisan manner that helps secure our election here in Ohio.
And the voting machines are not connected to the internet ever.
Ever. They're not connected to the internet. In Franklin County, you have an option. Most people like to vote on what we call our ballot markers. It's like a big electronic pencil. It doesn't retain your vote, but it allows you to vote electronically and then cast your skinny paper ballot into a ballot counter. You can also ask for a pre-printed ballot, but any of our ballot markers that you see in our voting locations, they are not connected to the internet, and they are tested prior to the election, again, by a Democrat and Republican in a bipartisan manner.
I like that it's kind of like the nuclear launch code. You need two keys at all times.
Absolutely.
I do want to ask about concerns about, say, angry voters, aggressive voters, intimidation, because you hear a lot of it nationally. And I wonder, how do you, in Franklin County, how do you prepare for, say, someone who forgets their ID and gets really mad and starts yelling?
I think what helps us here in Franklin County, we're talking about, you're talking about stress today. We have a very well-trained staff here in Franklin County. We have a very seasoned staff. The majority of the staff here have worked multiple, not only multiple elections, but multiple presidential elections. And so one of the things I stressed to our early vote staff before we began voting this year is we need to make sure that we show voters a lot of grace because you're going to have voters who show up who haven't voted since 2020, and election laws have changed since 2020. And so you may have a voter who shows up with a utility bill as a form of ID, and we can no longer accept that. And so there's an opportunity for us to educate that voter. But I think being prepared and understanding that voters, as much as we try to get the information out, and we do a pretty good job at it, not everyone will have the information they need. So having some grace and some understanding and walking voters through that process, I think helps us in dealing with those types of voters.
It's probably also important to point out that if you bring the wrong ID on election day, you can vote provisionally, right? And then you can come back with your license later and verify that you are, like, there is a way to still vote and then come back later with your ID, correct?
That's correct. Everyone will get a chance to vote. We determine voting by whether you'll vote a regular ballot or a provisional ballot. And so if you come to election day, or you come to your early vote center and you have your ID and it's expired, on election day, it's hard to get a new ID. So you can vote provisionally. And then you would have 4 days to come to the Board of Elections after November 5th to present a good ID to us so that we can count your ballot.
So don't panic. If you bring the wrong ID day of, you can go back and fix it.
You can fix it. And I want to again stress that because there's a lot of misinformation out there, that provisional ballots don't get checked or they only get checked if the race is close. And that's simply not true. In every county, and right here in Franklin County, we check every provisional ballot after the election with a bipartisan team.
You hear from battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, you hear them preparing for potential like voter intimidation, active shooter, perhaps like bomb threats. It sounds like perhaps Ohio is not getting the worst of the worst because it is not expected that our election will be as close as these other states. What do you hear from colleagues in other parts of Ohio and other parts of the country?
I don't know that Ohio's considered a battleground state anymore, but we
Right.
still prepare, as our colleagues across the country, we still prepare for those types of scenarios. And in Franklin County, all county boards of elections, we're required to go through that kind of election planning, disaster planning, contingency planning. So we have those plans in place. I think that, with the scrutiny of the election and what's good about this election, every presidential year, there's enthusiasm. There's a lot of people that want to vote. But again, there's always a lot of misinformation out there. So sometimes that makes our job a little bit more difficult, but there's also an opportunity to educate our voters and get them the correct information from trusted sources. I always stress, as a voter, you need to go to your trusted source of information. So that's your county board of election or the Ohio Secretary of State. That's where you can get the most accurate information.
And if I won't say something like the worst happens, because we certainly hope that there is no hiccups, but sometimes power goes out at a polling location. Sometimes, software goes down, other problems. On election day, where should we be checking to get the most accurate, up-to-date information if, say, our polling location has had to close because a water pipe burst?
Sure. Yeah, you'll want to call the Board of Elections. You want to in your local county, in here in Franklin County, 525-3100. We can get the information you need. But again, we prepare for those things as well. On election day, we have a generator crew, and that we train and we send out. So if there's a location that happens to lose power, we can send out a generator crew to help power up that location. All of our voting equipment has battery backups, so that won't stop voting in a location. So we have those contingency plans in place.
And I will say the reporting team here at WOSU will also be monitoring it all day and letting you know if there's been changes, disruptions. We'll be pulling information from Anton and sharing it with our listeners throughout the day. So I do want to ask a little bit about voter fraud because we hear a lot about it, and I wanted to hear from you. I guess I safe to say there has been voter fraud in Franklin County over the decades, but not in a way. Well, I guess I'll let you answer. So there has been voter fraud, but in what amounts, in what, and what do you do to push back against it?
There has been fraud. I mean, I think there's, it's very little. I mean, we don't see, I mean, when you think about the entire voting population of the state of Ohio, for example, you have over 8 million registered voters. Here in Franklin County, we have 903, a little over 903,000 voters. It's just not very rampant. Sometimes what you see is somebody who may vote a ballot here in Franklin County and then vote a ballot in another state. And when we become aware of that, we do investigate it. And we work with the Ohio Secretary of State. We work with our local county prosecutor, and we do try to investigate that to the best of our abilities. That's one thing that we can do amongst 100 other things that we do in terms of the elections. But we see it very little here in Franklin County and really across the state of Ohio.
Yeah, when you look at the Secretary of State, they refer people for prosecution to the Attorney General's office. And usually what you see after a big election is 80, 90, 100. And then you're talking about, let's say, 100 out of 5 million votes cast. 100 may feel like a lot, and we definitely want to bring those numbers down, but they did not alter the course of the election.
Not, no, it typically does not. And there's bad actors in anything out there, but when we know about it, we certainly try to go after it so that we can ensure that people understand that they have confidence that the vote was accurate and that things were secure.
And again, just that we have all those protections in place. You have that Republican and that Democrat touching everything to make sure that one party or the other is not monkeying with any part of the system.
That's right. That's correct.
So, safe to say, we should all be confident in the results from Franklin County on election night.
I think so. I think you can be confident in what you're going to see in the state of Ohio for November 5th. But when voters and people have questions, we're very transparent. We invite we have observers in our early vote center that are appointed by the political parties, and we're very transparent. So again, I always encourage people to seek out information, but do it from good sources. Your county board of election, your Ohio Secretary of State, that's where you're going to get the most accurate information.
That was Anton White, Director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Anna.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.